Welcome to Cato Audio for June 2021. I'm Caleb Brown. In this month's offering, Ben Cohen details the ways in which police are effectively above the law. New Mexico House Speaker Brian Egolf explains why his state eliminated qualified immunity. Stuart Buck of Arnold Ventures details why we need better criminal justice data. Cato's Aaron Parton gives the lay of the land on federal cannabis legalization. And Cato's Mustafa Akyol shows the harm caused by blasphemy laws around the world. Qualified immunity is a made-up Supreme Court doctrine that protects public officials from civil liability after they violate your rights. And the doctrine is, to be clear, an insult to Americans whose rights have been violated. Ben Cohen details some of those stories in Above the Law, How Qualified Immunity Protects Violent Police. We were joined by Cato's Jay Schweikert and Clark Neely. Before we started recording, Ben, we were talking about the effort to help people understand what qualified immunity is, and I compared it to civil forfeiture, which is the first time you explain it, people think that you're just making it up, and then you keep explaining it, and almost everybody says, "Well, that's terrible. We should get rid of that." And you take to that that task, that heavy lift of education with a new book, Above the Law: How Qualified Immunity Protects Violent Police. What was the goal here?
The goal was just to make it really clear and easy to understand for people about how police get let off the hook for committing crimes that if you or I or any regular person committed them, they'd be prosecuted and they'd be sued and they'd be found guilty. And somehow cops just get away with it because they're cops, because what, some judge decided that cops, otherwise known as law enforcement officers, are not really supposed to know the law unless some other cop broke the law
and was convicted of it.
Right.
Jay, when you or I are expected to understand what the law is in an area, what is it that ignorance is no excuse, we're told, but it seems to be a pretty good one for cops.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's a axiomatic proposition in our legal system that is a general matter. The mere fact that you don't know you're acting unlawfully isn't sufficient to excuse you from liability. And for ordinary citizens, that can actually lead to criminal prosecution under strict liability statutes that no one would really have reason to think they were violating. But when it comes to police officers, it's a different standard. And if you were to imagine any profession that you would expect to be held to a higher standard in this regard, you would think it would be the profession charged with knowing and enforcing the law. But in fact, law enforcement is held to a far lower standard than ordinary citizens and much lower than any other profession.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of absurd. I mean, this book has two or three pages stories for 17 people. In one situation, cops stole $200,000 in cash. There's no denying that that happened, but the judge let him off because of qualified immunity. In another situation, this woman who's seven months pregnant gets tased by the police, gets thrown down on the ground after a traffic stop, and the cops get off.
One of the stories that you feature here is Robert and Adlin Hart. This is the story that I just know as the tea leaves. And I know Clark and Jay, we've talked about this story before, but you know, whoever wants to, I think the details of this are worth going through again.
Well, I'll tackle this one. What's so incredible about this story? So this is a family that lives in Kansas. The mom and the dad are both retired CIA employees, just to add a little twist to it. And they grow hydroponic vegetables. And so they are observed by police coming out of a hydroponic store, which the police suspect is supplying people who grow marijuana at home. Now, the police have got themselves in a bit of a bind here because April 20th is coming up, and they've already scheduled a press conference where they're going to, you know, roll out somebody that they've busted for growing marijuana. The trouble is they don't have anybody. They haven't arrested anybody for this yet. And so they've got to find somebody for their press conference. And they do a trash pull on the Hart family, and they find some wet organic material, some wet leaves. And so when they put that together with the fact that they observed, I believe it was the husband and one of the kids coming out of a hydroponic store, they say, oh, these are, you know, this these are our guys, you know, we're gonna. So they do a, you know, they do what law enforcement euphemistically refers to as a dynamic entry, which is a SWAT entry. They put everybody down on the ground, and they do a field test of these these leaves, and they get a positive hit. But what they don't realize or they don't care is that the field test that they used also returns a positive hit for caffeine, and it turned out they were tea leaves. So long story short, the family is terrorized by a SWAT team. There's an arrest for marijuana possession. It all falls apart when they actually finally send the tea leaves to a real laboratory for testing and determine that they're not marijuana. And what happens next, which is that you have this long protracted legal dispute, and the courts step in to let the police off the hook by granting qualified immunity, which is basically what that has become the judiciary's job practically, is to just let rights violating police off the hook with qualified immunity. And that's why it's become such a travesty.
Yeah, and you've got judges that are complaining about it, that are saying this is outrageous, that I want to convict this person, but my hands are tied, and so they're up in arms.
These are all very brief chapters, little vignettes about qualified immunity. One of the pieces that you quote here is from Justice Reeves' bumper. A short excerpt from an order granting qualified immunity dated August 4th, 2020. Justice Carlton Reeves of the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Mississippi. What did he say?
This was a case where there was a black guy driving a Mercedes, and the cop says he pulled him over because he couldn't read his temporary license plate. And the cop keeps on insisting that you've got drugs in the car. And the guy says, no, I don't have drugs in the car. And, you know, you're not allowed to search my car. The cop keeps on saying, I want to search your car. And then the cop lies and says, I've got a report that you've got cocaine in your car. And the guy keeps on insisting, no, you can't search my car. And finally he gives up and says, okay, search my car. So the cop searches the guy's car, doesn't find anything, and that's not good enough. He calls in a drug-sniffing dog, searches his car, and, you know, this is not just looking around. He tears the guy's car apart. It's not drivable. He doesn't find anything. And so the driver of the car took the cop to court. Said this was illegal. You violated my constitutional rights. And the case again was thrown out by and this judge who was in that case was outraged that he had to throw that case out. And he wrote a decision talking about all the cases where cops had abused black people. And what else can a judge do except make as much noise as he can?
Yeah, he goes through sentence by sentence here of all of the things that Clarence Jameson was not doing wrong. He was not acting suspiciously. He was not behaving in a way that should have signaled to the cops that they could treat him in this manner. It is a really stunning piece of writing. Clark, Jay, we haven't really talked about this much, but we're recording this toward the end of April, and now we have two states and the city of Manhattan that have eliminated qualified immunity. What does it mean when states decide this is a no-go here? And, how does that change the calculus for the Supreme Court possibly?
Yeah. So starting with the states, you know, qualified immunity is a federal doctrine that applies to federal lawsuits. And of course, states don't have the authority to change federal law. But what states can do, and what New Mexico and Colorado have now already done, as well as the New York City Council, is enact state-level civil rights laws and specifically clarify that those civil rights laws will not allow qualified immunity as a defense. So what the states here are doing is recognizing that our federal civil rights system isn't working the way it's supposed to because of qualified immunity, and they're creating an alternative in state courts, which I think is an absolutely, you know, crucial and necessary step forward here, both because, you know, unfortunately, I don't think the Supreme Court is going to be reconsidering this doctrine. And I'm hopeful that we'll get a solution from Congress, but we haven't gotten one so far. So states really can play a leadership role on this issue and ensuring that the rights of their citizens will be protected.
Clark, does it make it easier for the Supreme Court to revisit this issue if a whole slew of states have said, nah, no go?
I'm not sure. I think the short answer is the Supreme Court has made fairly clear that it's not interested in taking a lead on fixing the qualified immunity problem. I think that's unfortunate because, of course, the Supreme Court created the qualified immunity problem by inventing the doctrine out of whole cloth. But the more legislative interest we see in addressing the situation, I think the less pressure there will be on the Supreme Court to take a lead role. Now, as we've noted, the Supreme Court will continue probably, you know, trying to sand off some of the rough edges, largely, I think, in an effort to prevent the judiciary from being embarrassed by some of the truly ridiculous cases that Ben cites in his book. But in terms of stepping up and effecting really systemic reform, I think that ship has sailed. And as Jay has explained in a very smart blog post, it's probably not a very good idea to look to the Supreme Court to save us from qualified immunity. That's going to be the job of Congress and state legislatures.
We have seen now what has been described as justice for George Floyd. That's not a fair characterization in my view, because George Floyd is dead. But Derek Chauvin was convicted on all charges that he faced in Minnesota. And I guess the other thing that's troubling about this case, to me at least, is that this case is notable.
Yeah, I think there's three things that we should keep in mind about the Derek Chauvin verdict when it comes to qualified immunity. The first is that just because this particular police officer was convicted for the misconduct that he committed, the murder that he committed, no one should suppose that this happens routinely or that police are reliably held accountable through the criminal justice system. It would be like looking at a plane crash and saying, oh, see, planes crash all the time. No, they don't. That just happened that one time and everybody noticed it. The second point is that not all police misconduct is a crime. And you have to have a civil rights avenue that ordinary citizens can initiate and pursue themselves so they don't have to try to rely on a prosecutor or rely on an internal affairs detective to initiate the process. So that's why we need a civil lawsuit as an avenue. The third point about the Derek Chauvin situation is that without qualified immunity, without citizen juries being able to send a signal to members of law enforcement on a systemic basis, police just aren't going to know what we expect of them when it comes to the use of force. So in effect, judges have distorted the feedback that police are getting. And instead of regular, continuous, accurate feedback that they would get through a civil damages regime, police get sporadic and inaccurate feedback from a relentlessly government-favoring judiciary. And that has got to stop, because clearly there is a disconnect between what we as the public expect from police and what they think is expected of them. That has got to change.
And the only thing I would add to that is regarding the Derek Chauvin case is, I've heard some people object that, well, you know, George Floyd's family, you know, already got like a large settlement from the city of Minneapolis. So obviously qualified immunity didn't prevent that from happening. And while that's technically true, you know, this it's worth keeping in mind that this is the highest profile police killing in at least a decade, if not ever. And so this is an extraordinary circumstance where there was extraordinary national pressure on the city to resolve this, resolve the civil lawsuit in a way that, you know, would seem fair and appropriate. And I think it's good that happened for George Floyd's family. But it is not it should not by any means be taken as something that would be typical of what happens in the aftermath of an unlawful police killing. And the unfortunate fact is that had this case not settled, even though Derek Chauvin was convicted of murder, it is entirely possible that in a civil suit, he would have been entitled to qualified immunity, because it would have come down to whether there was a prior case in the Eighth Circuit involving sufficiently similar facts. So, you know, George Floyd's family did get, you know, a significant settlement in this case, but we need a solution that works in the typical case where there is not a national spotlight on the incident.
Yeah, you know, we regular old people tend to think that, oh, this is just now starting. That and the only times when cops are committing heinous crimes are when they're caught on video camera. And the reality is that this behavior has been going on for, I don't know, a hundred years. And we are just starting to find out about it because of video cameras. And there's still, you know, hundreds and hundreds of cases of police acting in such an abusive way that we never hear about. And, you know, we tend to focus on fatalities, murders, people who lose their lives. But, you know, just the everyday of cops beating someone up, you know, abusing them physically, verbally.
Stealing.
is a behavior that continues and is way in excess of what we ever hear about.
Ben Cohen is author of Above the Law. Clark Neely is a senior vice president at the Cato Institute. And Jay Schweikert is a policy analyst at the Cato Institute. Two states have decided to eliminate the doctrine of qualified immunity for the purposes of state lawsuits against police. Brian Egolf is the Democratic Speaker of the House in New Mexico, which eliminated assertions of qualified immunity in state courts for almost all public officials. We talked about the whys and hows of providing state-level relief for violations of the rights of New Mexicans. New Mexico has an interesting distinction in that two libertarian wish list items New Mexico has done legislatively, and that was eliminating civil asset forfeiture in the state, and most recently, eliminating qualified immunity for almost all public officials. And that's a distinction there worth making. How did this come together?
Well, I think for these two wish list items, as you put it, they make good common sense to a lot of people. We in New Mexico are proud that we have a multicultural state, that we respect each other, we listen to each other, we want to make sure that we take care of one another. Along with that are some of the Western American values of personal responsibility and accountability. And you see that come through in many, many things that we do here in New Mexico with the elimination of civil asset forfeiture. I think we wanted to get rid of a policy that was straight up unfair. You get pulled over. You are not convicted. Sometimes you're not even charged with a serious crime, but whatever personal property you had in your vehicle, it now belongs to the police. When you say that to legislators, when you describe that circumstance, people don't really understand how that's possible.
Yeah, they don't believe it. And then you have to keep explaining it.
That's exactly right. You know, when we have policy that is just bananas, You have to explain it over and over again because you have to get over that hump of incredulity. And that is what led me to want to get into the fight to eliminate qualified immunity.
So let's think about, what was the partisan breakdown here? You're the Speaker of the House. You carried this bill yourself, which is itself a pretty big statement when you have a member of House leadership carrying a bill, and that pretty much says this is a priority of this body.
Right. This is I've carried two bills since I've become Speaker. That was a bit of a break with New Mexico tradition. Often, you know, the Speaker of the House, you know, would carry lots of bills, but I decided to go the opposite direction and really try to become someone who administered operations in the House. But there were two bills that I've sponsored or that I've carried since becoming Speaker. One was the bill to create the New Mexico Civil Rights Commission, whose work led to the introduction of the Civil Rights Act. And then the second bill would be the Civil Rights Act itself. And I, when we were working to create the Civil Rights Commission, I told a story going back to this idea of incredulity, or just, you know, you can't believe that the law is what it is. My law partner had a federal civil rights case. She was representing a young boy who was the victim of repeat horrific sexual abuse and sexual assault, molestation at the hands of foster parents in New Mexico. And she went to federal court. The foster parents were deemed to be state actors, which is the legal term of art that you need to establish before you can proceed with a civil rights claim. But we, or she, my law partner, ended up losing the case because of qualified immunity, because there was not a 10th Circuit decision that informed foster parents that committing sexual assault and molesting a child deprives that child of rights guaranteed to the child by the U.S. Constitution. And explained it to me over and over again, and I just could not believe that a young child suffering horrific abuse couldn't get justice in the courts because of qualified immunity. Then I started to follow the work of Justin Amash in Congress and his work, and that's what led to the Civil Rights Commission being created, really in the immediate aftermath of the murder of George Floyd. You know, so there was another aspect to this work that was responsive to what was happening around the country and what was happening right here in New Mexico.
What was the partisan breakdown of these votes, and how supportive was the governor?
It was, unfortunately, not a bipartisan effort. Well, we worked hard to get Republican support for the bill. We did not get a single Republican vote for the New Mexico Civil Rights Act. It had very broad support among the Democratic Party, and the governor was involved throughout the process and was very supportive. He ultimately signed the bill. We made many changes to the legislation as it went through the process, addressing concerns about the scope and breadth of the bill. There were some technical changes. We wanted to hear concerns and criticism and then respond to that. So the bill as passed was substantially different than it was when it was introduced, but we maintained the core portions, which were abolishment of qualified immunity and a state cause of action to vindicate rights secured by the New Mexico Bill of Rights.
So you mentioned something before we started recording, and I want to make sure that you have a chance to reiterate it here, which is qualified immunity as a doctrine established by the U.S. Supreme Court is, in a sense, the height of judicial activism. And that is something that conservatives, many Republicans, claim to really hate about our judicial system. And yet here it is.
Yeah, I mean, we hear, I would say, 99.9% of the comment and criticism of so-called judicial activism or judge-created law, in my experience, comes from Republicans, comes from conservatives. Here, with qualified immunity, you have a legal doctrine, what is essentially a law, created out of whole cloth by the United States Supreme Court. It has never been passed or adopted by Congress. I don't believe it's ever been passed or adopted by any state legislature. It is the height of judicial activism. It is the apex of judge-created law. Yet we couldn't find in New Mexico a single Republican to stand with us as we abolished a doctrine that does injustice to so many people every year and blocks essential accountability for government officials that trample on the constitutional rights of Americans. It's disappointing, but despite the disappointment, we'll proceed and everyone will be able to enjoy the benefits of the law, Republican or Democrat, just the same.
The governor was supportive. You were unable to get Republican votes on this bill. But what about interest groups that have a stake in the outcome here? What was the response from, say, police or other civil rights groups?
Well, this bill brought together literally the Koch family and the ACLU, so Americans for Prosperity and the ACLU were on board in helping to get this bill passed. Cato did tremendous work to help get this bill passed, supplied excellent expert insight and research data, and was critical to passage. We had the whole spectrum of organizations. We had the Sierra Club, we had Planned Parenthood, we had the ACLU, we had Americans for Prosperity, we had Cato. I mean, it was across the political spectrum. I truly had never seen a coalition of organizations like the coalition that formed around the Civil Rights Act. And I think it's because people saw it as a tool to protect individuals, to make sure that individual liberty, whether it's liberty to enjoy the security and sanctity of your person, the liberty to enjoy a clean environment, to have personal autonomy, all of these interests came together and provided a very powerful coalition. Law enforcement was almost uniformly opposed to the bill because of, I think, some misunderstandings and misinformation that led the conversation at the beginning. Police officers were basically misinformed about what the bill did and how it affects individual law enforcement officers and local government. So county governments, city governments were not supportive for reasons of what they said were cost and worries that they would lose their insurance policies if this bill were to become the law. So it was very important to have this broad coalition of outside organizations supporting the bill to counter what ordinarily would have been extremely influential opposition from county governments. The Association of Counties is a very significant player in the state legislature, as it, I'm sure, is in other states. So we needed all the help we could get to overcome the county's objections.
So what would your message be to lawmakers in, let's just pick two states at random, Minnesota and Kentucky?
The message would be explain the clearest example of injustice that comes because of qualified immunity. Tell the story. The story that I told just a minute ago about my law partner's case. When people hear those types of stories, that their constituents, their fellow Kentuckians or Minnesotans are denied justice in court because of qualified immunity. Those stories need to be told to legislators. Those stories need to be told to policymakers. I then would say, put a bill into the process with an understanding at the front end that you need all sides to speak and to be heard on this policy decision. And don't be afraid to make changes to your bill. Don't be afraid to make changes to the policy to address legitimate concerns, so long as you're maintaining the core of what you're working toward. But law enforcement is a powerful voice in the conversation. It's important to acknowledge that this is not just about police officers. I think it's important to acknowledge that the vast, vast majority of police officers are good people who want to help their community. But every once in a while, and, I shouldn't even say every once in a while. I think, too often, a very small number of, bad police officers commit horrific crimes, like the murder of George Floyd. But you don't want to paint all of law enforcement with a broad brush, because it's not fair, it's not accurate. And so listening to them, making sure that their voice is part of the conversation is essential.
Democrat Brian Eagolf is the Speaker of the New Mexico House. It's hard to get criminal justice data from states. The data we can access is quite bad. Stuart Buck is the vice president for research at Arnold Ventures. He argues that in order to improve the quality of policing, to focus on areas needing genuine reform, we need better data. He spoke for the Cato Daily podcast. How do you evaluate the current status of collecting criminal justice data in both a format and a rigorous way that makes it useful for people trying to study trends in criminal justice?
Right. So one of the examples comes from a book on misdemeanors by Alexandra Natapoff, who's a scholar who studies these issues. And she was trying to write about misdemeanors across America. And one of the early chapters in her book goes into the extraordinary difficulty of just estimating how many misdemeanors occur across the country each year. You might think this is simple, just a simple counting exercise, like counting the number of, states or counties in the country. But it's not so. It turns out that some states don't really report the number of misdemeanors that they prosecuted in a given year. Of the states that do report the number, they do it in wildly inconsistent ways. So you will see one state that has, let's say, X number of misdemeanors, and the neighboring state, for no apparent reason, has 3X the number of misdemeanors. And, she's trying to puzzle, well, why would that be? It turns out the second state is counting all traffic stops as misdemeanors, and the first state wasn't counting traffic stops. So obviously, there are millions of traffic stops every year. If you count them as misdemeanors, all of a sudden that makes misdemeanor a very different category of offense. So even just counting the number of misdemeanors is something that's very hard. Counting the number of people in jail is also very hard. So there's a researcher at the Brennan Center who wrote, "We tried to develop an estimate of unique jail admissions annually to understand the population. It's impossible. The data to do it just don't exist. And where they do exist, they're contradictory." So those are just a couple of examples where it's hard to get even the most basic elementary information about just what's occurring in the criminal justice system.
I spoke with the Cato Institute's Walter Olson recently about hate crime data in the United States. Following our recording for the podcast, John Pfaff, who studies these issues extensively, said that might be the one area of criminal law where we would be better off not collecting the data.
Right. I mean, it's like it's better to have nothing at all than to have data and information that is completely misleading, because, you know, some states or localities are counting completely different things as hate crimes, and some states aren't counting anything at all. So in that case, it, you know, it looks like you have data or some data, but it's actually misleading. So, yeah, it's better not to be actively misled into thinking that some states are hundreds of times more hateful than other states, when that's just completely an artifact of how the data is being defined and collected and reported.
So the feds cannot really compel states to provide this kind of data in a uniform format. And we could argue about whether that's on net good or bad. But to the extent states are interested in providing data that is useful, what should they be looking at? I mean, I've seen the Measures for Justice Project, and I know that they've had a very difficult time trying to collect data in a consistent format. But to the extent that state lawmakers, even police agencies, are probably interested in knowing how well they stack up against other police agencies in other states, but where should they start?
That's a great question. So the federal government, I would say, is not completely impotent here. I mean, based on conditions attached to federal funding that goes out across the country to different state agencies, the federal government often attaches conditions to that funding, some of which are, you know, report the number of crimes that occur. And so we have the FBI's Uniform Crime Reports, or UCR, data that's existed for years. They've been trying to switch to a different system. We could get deep into the weeds with people complaining that the newer updated system is also very inadequate and, you know, inconsistently reported from different states. So anyway, the point is that the federal government is not, you know, completely impotent here. There's also some efforts by the Council on State Governments. They got a grant from the Bureau of Justice Affairs, which is this, I guess, kind of subunit of the Department of Justice, to try to define better data standards in criminal justice. Doing so, I mean, not with the idea of forcing states to come along, but, you know, trying to invite states to collaborate and come up with some consistent data standards for some of these issues. And so I think there's enough people, hopefully, that are interested in being able to, as you say, compare across states and just know what's going on. It doesn't make sense that so many states and so many counties are doing things in their own siloed, unique, idiosyncratic way. I think there's room for both conditions attached to federal funding, and there's room for just collaborative efforts like the Council on State Governments is leading.
Yeah, there are, many states enter these compacts with other states for accounting standards, for other kinds of measurement standards when it comes to public finance. I can't imagine that it's that difficult to put together a set of standards that would work across states that relates specifically to criminal justice.
Yeah. I mean, one of the issues here is that, you know, some of this stuff is so deep into the weeds and so technical. It's not a sexy political issue like, you know, talking about should we defund the police or not. But I think it's actually in some ways more important, because, you know, some of these other issues get so polarized and are, you know, hot button topics, you know, to debate or talk about. But at the end of the day, like, no matter what sorts of policies we have regarding how the police are funded or how the system works, we need better data just to figure out what's going on and to figure out what is working and what's not, and who's subjected to the system and how. I mean, those are kinds of basic fundamental issues that people on all sides should agree. It's better to have more data that's more consistent and that actually makes sense, as opposed to having, you know, a complete lack of data or data that's just wildly inconsistent and can't be compared from one place to the next.
And he would hate to imagine that protests, widespread protests, are being done in the name of something that is rooted in bad data. You want the protest to represent something that is true and accurate and fair, and you want it to be something that we can measure over time to see if we're making progress on treating people with the due process that they're entitled to.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And that second point is especially important, because if we should all want to know what's working in the criminal justice system, you know, no matter what our goals are. I mean, if your goal is to, you know, reduce the number of days that people who are not yet judged guilty stay in jail, then you won't know whether that's happening if you can't even count the number of people in jail or count the number of days they're spending there without some heroic effort to kind of reconstruct the data, and reinvent the wheel, right? We need just more basic information. And then whatever policy is at issue, we could all benefit from knowing, what are the trends, what seems to be working, what seems to be going in a particular direction, whether positive or negative.
Do the feds do this better?
Probably at some level, just because of more resources, better staffing at the federal government than say at the local county level, in the 3,000 plus counties across the United States. That's not to say the federal government is by any means perfect. And the Bureau of Justice statistics for quite a while has arguably been underfunded compared to other statistical agencies at the federal level. It doesn't publish data as often as criminal justice scholars would like. I think there's a lot the federal government can do to improve.
But in terms of states doing this together, it seems like the movement that is needed is for states to agree, one, we want to do this better, mm-hmm. and two, we want to know if we're making progress. I mean, it's the United States imprisons so many people and we spend so much money on police. I mean, larger than most militaries around the world, that we would like to know whether that money's being spent wisely.
Yeah, absolutely. And yet, as I said, we have so little data on this. So, for example, there's this Princeton professor named Jonathan Mummelow. He's a political scientist, but he writes about criminal justice and policing issues. He wrote an article for The Atlantic a couple of years ago where he was trying to just collect data on the militarization of police. This phenomenon where police get like donated or surplus military equipment. And so oftentimes you'll see photos of these protests and it looks like the police look like they're in a war zone, decked out with all kinds of equipment, sometimes tanks, et cetera. So what Mummelow said in his article was that in a federalist system with more than 15,000 state and local law enforcement agencies and virtually no standardized reporting requirements, reliable and comprehensive data on police behavior have eluded scholars for decades. And that's just with regard to policing, right? So police are just one aspect of the criminal justice system. There's also jails, courthouses, prosecutors, which are especially a black box as to the data on what they're doing and how they're making decisions. Then you've got prisons. I mean, there's so many different agencies that are involved in the criminal justice system at some level. And oftentimes, even within the same county, it's hard to get data where you could just figure out what happens to a particular person, a particular defendant, as they move from being arrested by the police to showing up at a jail, to showing up at the courthouse and so forth. It's hard to figure out who the same people are, let alone what happens to them and why, which are the really important questions that people interested in policy would want to know.
What has the research that your team has done, what does that tell us?
Well, I mean, our team, we spearheaded this report that we're calling Campaign for Criminal Justice Data Modernization, that we got 25 plus experts and scholars to sign on to. And I'm sure many more would. I mean, we couldn't survey it the whole nation. But the basic thrust of this report is that there are several actions the Biden administration should take or could take to try to improve criminal justice data across the country, including pushing for greater transparency, transparency around things like police abuse incidents or allegations. Like that's something that's not often publicly reported, and police unions often try to prevent it from being publicly reported, improving data quality, the quality of how data is collected and reported, improving the connections between data, between different state and county agencies, and just improving the technology, the data systems at issue. So maybe improving procurement policies so that we get better technological systems in there. So that's not in the way. So anyway, I think a useful roadmap for the federal government and for how the Biden administration could take some active steps to improve criminal justice data. And if they take up any of the recommendations, I think that would be progress.
Stuart Buck is the Vice President for Research at Arnold Ventures. Congress is looking more seriously at ending cannabis prohibition at the federal level. Most Americans, 60% or so, now live in state jurisdictions where recreational marijuana is either legal or decriminalized. Cato's Aaron Parton details the move to end cannabis prohibition, why it represents a long and coming victory for freedom. We've seen a lot of efforts recently at the federal level to reform cannabis law, that is, to end prohibition of marijuana. Where do things stand right now?
Currently, there's legislation that we are expecting to be introduced in the Senate soon. Senators Chuck Schumer, Cory Booker, and Ron Wyden have been leading this charge to get some sort of legislation put forward this session. This is nothing particularly new. Over the past several years, there have been a number of attempts, largely driven by members of the House, to decriminalize or legalize marijuana on the federal level. Those have been so far unsuccessful. As with any hot button issue, the hardest part is really getting the bipartisan support necessary, the votes necessary to pass this legislation.
Now, you make note in a blog post with Cato's Jeff Myron that 60%, nearly 60% of Americans live in a state where recreational marijuana use and possession are either legal or decriminalized. That's a really a stunning fact. And of course, we're sitting at a time in which support for ending cannabis prohibition is at an all-time high.
Yeah. So recent polls show that nearly 7 in 10 Americans support ending the criminalization of marijuana or cannabis products, whether that's through decriminalization measures, which have been gaining traction in states recently, or through legalization, which has also been gaining traction. Most recently, New York and Virginia are the two latest members to kind of come to the party, so to speak, and get on board with legalized recreational marijuana use. At this point, any states that haven't jumped on board yet are really kind of fighting. They're going against the current, so to speak. It almost seems inevitable. Of course, nothing's inevitable. This federal push won't have any direct impact on whether or not states do inevitably legalize, but it will possibly push for legislators and grassroots level referendums to start popping up in these new states.
So what has the state experience been? I know you have attempted to estimate what the fiscal impact has been for state budgets, but so what have you found?
Well, we found that marijuana legalization is a fantastic source of tax revenue. We've examined, of course, Washington, Oregon, Colorado in depth. Those are states that were early adopters of legal marijuana regimes, and they've had a huge amount of success in generating revenue primarily through establishing systems of legal sale. And that's, of course, you know, the big hurdle for many states. It's easy to say, okay, cannabis is legal now. It's a lot harder to set up a structure that regulates the growth, the sale, the manufacture of cannabis derivatives. And for naysayers, for those arguing against the legalization of marijuana, we really don't find that many impacts. You do see a slightly increased use of marijuana in states that have legalized it. You would expect to see that in terms of effects on test scores for high school and middle school students, in terms of traffic accidents and fatalities and other public health indicators. You really don't see much, if any, movement. So we can kind of say overall the impact of marijuana legalization hasn't been so much a boom as just, you know, a little pop.
I spoke recently with Jim Higdon. He is a cannabis entrepreneur in Kentucky and a former journalist who covered this issue extensively. And he said that the farm bill is the way to go. And I think he shared probably some similar concerns that you or I would share, which is, if you're concerned about excessive federal regulation in this industry, where, as you point out, we've seen almost no real impact on things like test scores or traffic fatalities, things that are would be considered negative indicators under a legalization regime. He says if you want to avoid all of that, just increase the allowable THC content under the Farm Bill, and suddenly what everyone knows as marijuana is legal, and you haven't created this superstructure of regulation.
Right. And I think that approach has some merit. Where that approach falls possibly a little bit short is many of the advocates, including Senators Schumer, Booker, and Wyden, are really focusing on kind of attacking two problems at once. First, decriminalize cannabis federally. And second, take a approach, try to attack the criminal justice side of the issue by expunging records, by ending enforcement, by dropping cases currently pending. So if it kind of depends at the end of the day what the goal is. I think even decriminalization, which falls short of legalization, and I think that's an important distinction. At the end of the day, you know, it's decriminalization is a baby step, but it's still a step in the right direction.
Younger people may not know this, but President Joe Biden back in the 90s was a big-time drug warrior and seemed to revel in putting people in jail for crimes such as those that would get you popped involving cannabis. Do we have any sense of where he is on this today?
Right. I think if anything, President Biden might be a larger hurdle than getting 60 votes in the Senate. His administration has not said much in recent weeks or months, but from the campaign trail and from his history, he is very much against legalization and might be lukewarm at best on the issue of decriminalization. So at the end of the day, I think if the Senate is able to find an adequate number of votes to pass any legislation that may be introduced in the coming days and weeks, I don't think that President Biden would choose to veto it. He might be a little bit loath to accept the new status quo, but I think he realizes that it is, with public opinion shifting the way it has in the past several years, it's a losing battle. And I don't think one that he would choose to take.
One of the arguments I hear that also with my podcast with Jim Higdon, a point that he made is that a lot of the cannabis products that flow into states where it is still prohibited, a lot of those products might very well be junk or worse than junk. It could be actively damaging to people, and that may be because this is a product that did not pass legal muster in the states where cannabis has been legalized. So for the remaining states, the 40-some percent of Americans who live in states where cannabis has not been made legal for or decriminalized for recreational purposes, that could be a severe problem.
Right. And that gets to the heart of why prohibition doesn't and never has worked. People will always find black or gray markets to go to. The products in those markets are typically unregulated, frequently unsafe. You know, going back to the bathtub gin of alcohol prohibition, you don't know what you're getting, and your suppliers don't have any incentive to make sure that the product they give you is safe, because if it harms you, they'd face no consequences. You're not going to, you know, call the authorities and say, "Hi, I illegally purchased these drugs. I would like to turn in my supplier because they made me sick." It's just going to be you by yourself. Hopefully not too sick.
So the DEA and the president, there's this weird scheduling of drugs that we have, where we're in a situation right now where cocaine is a Schedule II drug, cannabis is a Schedule I drug, which Schedule I indicates no medical value and high potential for abuse. Cocaine apparently doesn't quite meet that qualification, but where does scheduling stand now, something that could be done effectively without Congress?
Right. The DEA could, if they chose to, deschedule or reschedule marijuana in the, you know, tomorrow. Of course, there are some administrative burdens. It would take some time, but that is an option. However, they seem to have no inclination to do so. As you said, right now, marijuana is classified as a Schedule I substance, having no medicinal value and a high potential for abuse. The no medicinal value is a dubious claim at best, given the growing medical and scientific literature surrounding research related to the effects of cannabis on health issues such as glaucoma, depression, pain, and the like. There's actually a case right now in the Ninth Circuit, Sisley v. DEA, where the complainants are attempting to compel the DEA to reschedule marijuana, arguing that given that 2/3 of the states have legalized medical marijuana in some form, the argument that marijuana has no medicinal use is entirely inaccurate. That's, of course, I believe that case was originally filed in 2019. It's still working its way through the courts, but it will be interesting to keep an eye on that and see whether or not the DEA is instructed to rethink how they classify marijuana.
Aaron Pardon is a research associate at the Cato Institute. Countries around the world have criminal blasphemy laws, according to a recent report by the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Mob activity, threats, and violence based on accusations of blasphemy are also common in some of those countries. The result is the silencing of millions of people and the direct persecution of hundreds of people every year by law or vigilantism for merely expressing their ideas and opinions. At a Cato Institute event in February, Cato's Mustafa Akyol, author of the new book Reopening Muslim Minds, describes some of the costs of blasphemy laws throughout the world.
Now, as a Muslim who's looking into these issues, and as someone who's been thinking about issues of freedom in Islam, this makes me sad, and it shows me that we need some work to do. And I think responsible Muslim clerics, opinion leaders, political leaders, intellectuals have some work to do on this. And there are efforts, of course, for reforming blasphemy laws. A lot of scholars have written important articles. There are movements, there are calls in the Muslim world to getting away with not just blasphemy laws, but any other act of coercion in the name of Islam. That would include apostasy laws, that would include religious policing, let alone other forms of violence. Therefore, I'll say a few things from the Islamic point of view. First of all, I think we should see here that beyond religion or even beneath religion, there's something else here at play, what social scientists call sometimes honor culture. It refers to a culture where one's reputation or values, religious or not, is eagerly protected by force. No wonder honor culture leads to what we can call secular blasphemy laws. My home country, Turkey, as you mentioned, is a severe case of that. Since 2014, more than 60,000 people have been prosecuted in Turkey, and thousands of them have been given prison sentences for insulting not God or the Prophet, but the president. This may, in fact, be the most severe blasphemy, one of the most severe blasphemy crises in the world right now, if we define the term blasphemy a bit broadly. But besides that, besides honor culture, nationalist pride, and all those sort of things that also suppress free speech, there's clearly an issue with understanding of religion and religious values and religious law in the Muslim context. So I'll say a few things about that. And I should say that the laws in question, for example, in Pakistan, people sometimes remind that they are left over from the colonial era, which is true technically, but most of the laws are in Pakistan or some post-colonial Muslim societies are left over from that era, which is a problem in itself, a grim era in itself. But they have been strengthened and they have been made more severe and more definitive with a clearly Islamic ambition to silence blasphemy. I call Islamic, you know, relatively speaking, of course, not every Muslim would agree with that, which should bring us to an honest discussion about blasphemy laws within Islam as a religion, within the religious law tradition in Islam, the Sharia, and its interpretation by the jurists, the fuqaha. And when we look into that, we will see a clearly grim picture, and that is medieval Islamic jurists considered blasphemy as a capital crime. That is true for the four main Sunni schools and the main Shia school, the Ja'fari school. They all consider it's a capital crime, sab Allah or sab al-Rasul, which is insult of God and the Prophet. Those people who did this should be executed. They just disagreed on whether, you know, the blasphemer can repent or not. It is interesting that they made, they were even harsher on the insult of Prophet more than God. For an interesting reasoning, they thought because God will punish a blasphemer on his own, he has his ultimate presence, but the Prophet is dead and he's gone, we have to protect the Prophet on his behalf after he's gone. So those medieval verdicts in Islamic jurisprudence are there. It's death penalty for blasphemers. Not all Muslims are certainly eager to implement these laws. Many Muslims are not even aware of them, but some are. These are the people that we call Islamists, and Marvi described that scene in Pakistan, how it works as a force in society that even calls on the state, and if the state even doesn't, does its own, the act of punishing blasphemy through violence. So those forces are there because those are, they are convicted that this is the Islamic thing to do. It's written in medieval jurisprudence. And a small extremist strain within that Islamist universe even believes in implementing this as terrorism in the middle of Europe, which is what we saw in France, unfortunately, in the horrific terrorist attacks there in the past decade. So I believe an honest conversation is needed. And an honest conversation to face these blasphemy laws and to repeal them is needed. And for that, it's a huge topic, which I cover in my forthcoming book, Reopening Muslim Minds. But I'll just here highlight three points. One is that I think Muslims who believe in blasphemy laws should see that these laws appeared in a historical context where everybody had blasphemy laws. I mean, by everybody, I'm referring to especially in particular to the Byzantine and Sassanid empires who had similar blasphemy laws. These were the empires that Muslims faced and partly inherited in terms of even their legal notions. When you look into Sassanid laws, for example, that ban enmity towards gods, it sounds very similar to some of the things written in the Muslim literature about blasphemy. And so therefore, when Muslims look into what's written in their jurisprudence books, they should consider that maybe they're not looking into the eternal principles of Islam, but just a bygone archaic era in human history. Second, blasphemy laws are justified through some episodes written in the biographies of the Prophet, peace be upon him, where we hear that some people insulted the Prophet or wrote satirical poets against him, and then they were executed by early Muslims. So this is taken as a precedent to establish blasphemy laws. But if you look into those stories more carefully, which I do in my forthcoming book, you see that the issue there was not mere satire or criticism or insult, but active enmity in terms of physical attacks or incitement to war or at least violence against Muslims. Meanwhile, there are reports that Prophet actually didn't punish who insulted him, but quite the contrary, showed them grace and mercy. And I think that's probably the more universal lesson we should derive from the life of the Prophet. Third, the only undisputed source in Islam, every Muslim would agree with that, is the Quran. And when you look into the Quran on this issue, everybody can see that there is no earthly punishment in the Quran for blasphemy, for apostasy, for that matter. The most relevant verse of the Quran to this issue is verse Nisa 124 or 4:124, which I've referred to in various writings to Muslims. It says, if you hear people denying and ridiculing God's revelation, do not sit with them unless they start to talk of other things. So the verse doesn't say go and attack people if they ridicule Islam. It doesn't even say silence them. It just says do not sit with those people, which means just disengage. I think this can be very well the basis of a proper Muslim response to blasphemy in the modern world. If there are people who criticize Islam, who offend Islam, don't listen to them. Don't join their events, or you know, maybe you can boycott them. You may stop buying their magazine if you are buying. But there's no justification really in the Quran for coercion, for violence, for killing people, for jailing people. So with such, I think, arguments, there needs to be a stronger push in the Muslim world. And also, I think Muslims who are eager to punish blasphemy by force should realize that they're just killing and tormenting innocent people one after another. In Pakistan, most burning case, but other places as well. And by killing and tormenting innocent people in the name of your faith, you're not bringing any honor to your faith. You're just bringing shame. So this is what I think from an Islamic point of view, and this is what I see as the Islamic antidote to the radicalism in the name of Islam, as we see in this issue. And I think seeing what is happening on the ground should show us, to Muslims who are listening to us in Pakistan or elsewhere, how important this issue is, how much of a problem, a stain on the honor of Islam this issue is right now in the world. And here are some of the arguments that we can use to move forward.
Mustafa Akyol is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. In the past 50 years, the United States experienced three major medical malpractice crises, each fostering a vigorous, politicized debate about the causes of premium spikes and the impact on access to care and defensive medicine. In a new book from the Cato Institute, Medical Malpractice Litigation, How It Works, Why Tort Reform Hasn't Helped. Experts in the field and from across the political spectrum provide an accessible, fact-based response to the questions that ordinary Americans and policymakers have about the performance of the medical malpractice litigation system. Get your copy today at cato.org and online retailers nationwide. That will do it for this edition of Cato Audio. I'm Caleb Brown. Talk to you again next month.